Hello and welcome to another episode of Cloud Security Podcast. Now, this is a special episode because we've just kicked off a new series of This Is My Security Architecture. We've kicked off our first episode. The first episode of this series is with one of our previous guests, Sai Gunaranjan. Now, this episode is probably best seen on our video platform, so you can check it out on our YouTube, LinkedIn, and also on Spotify, because that does allow you to see the video version of this. However, it does also make for a really good podcast episode, so we thought we'll release it in podcast form as well. Fun fact, we are recording this in the airport as we make our way to New York for our very first cloud security meetup in New York, which is going to be one with a twist, which is going to be in line with Fashion Week. So do bring your tech Fashion Week and we'll see you there. But for now, let's head over to This Is My Security Architecture, the Azure Part 1.
Today's the beginning of my This Is My Security Architecture series, and we're talking about Azure today. The way we're going to do this is we're going to talk about the basic foundation pieces of Azure for people who may be from AWS or may not have never worked with Azure. And then we're going to go into what are some of the subcategories of things that they should worry about in Azure. And towards the end, how do you scale security in Azure? Did I get that right, Sai? Yeah. Is that kind of what we're talking today?
Yep.
Awesome. And could you share a bit about yourself as well for people who may not know a bit about yourself?
Sure. So hi, everyone. My name is Sai Gunaranjan. I'm part of the cloud platform team with Veradigm, the Veradigm networks. My responsibility is to maintain Azure and Azure DevOps and GitHub platforms at the enterprise level in an organization, and responsible for the overall security and availability of the platform and the various applications that we host.
Awesome. Sounds like a huge responsibility, man. I'm glad you're here to tell us both about what you can do for. So let's start with the basics first then. For people who may not have heard much about the Azure space, what are some of the foundational pieces people normally start with in Azure?
So I think first thing is to get a tenant, you know, subscribe for Azure, the Azure services. You would actually start getting a tenant from, tenant basically means it's an Active Directory, Azure Active Directory tenant you get, and under Azure Active Directory you have multiple services. Azure is one of them, and then you have Office 365, and you have other services as well that tie into the overall tenant that you actually create. So tenant is basically your identity context, everything that's part of the tenant, all the user IDs, everything a part of that, groups and everything. And you actually assign permissions, we do access management and everything from the tenant onwards. If you have other services like Office 365, Microsoft 365, Intune, all of them also fit into the same tenant, and that's where you have Exchange Online or SharePoint and everything. Basically, all of them are clubbed into one Azure Active Directory tenant.
Right.
Azure Portal is one of, is this a subset of Azure Active Directory?
Yeah, because this is kind of like for people who may have the AWS context, which is like a learning for me as well. Because in AWS context, we just say, oh, you have accounts. And then like, oh, you have multiple accounts, or you have one account, 25 account. But in the Azure space, because it's like almost like a Google Cloud, if I were to use that example, where you have, they have their own mail, which is Office 365. They have SharePoint. They have all these other tools or services that they have actually offer to people. So from that perspective, it's more like a sub product within a big product. Is that right?
It's a collection of cloud services, to simplify. Like, it's like, you know, various services. Some of them are SaaS based, like Power BI, Office 365. They're a different kind of service, and then Azure supports more of IaaS and PaaS based services as well. So, but all of them are tied into the tenant, and subscriptions are one of the components of larger tenant from an enterprise point of view. If you want to see it that way, it's the same Active Directory that gets used for other services as well. That's Microsoft related. Other cloud services are Microsoft related.
Yeah. So to your point, then, if you're trying to build the security architecture for an Azure, your identity is Active Directory. I'm assuming that's the only thing you can have in Active Directory as an identity.
You default with Azure Active Directory. You could definitely integrate with other services as well. Do like B2B or B2C kind of services, but that will be your first thing to start off with. Yeah.
And I think so. You have your identity sorted. So essentially, I'm signing up for going on Azure portal, signing up, linking it to my Azure Active Directory. Then I am in, I guess.
Yeah. So once you have that, then you sign up for a subscription. Subscriptions come with various flavors. You know, you get like dev test subscriptions, you have enterprise subscriptions, which come under the EA. Then you have pay-as-you-go. sign up for a subscription, and once you sign up for a subscription, you start to get access to create resources within the subscription, which could be your virtual networks, machines, SQL databases, or whatever, like, you know, whatever you want to create within the subscription.
Right. Okay. So now subscription is the equivalent, like, so you can have basically, it's like a, the way I'm coming from is one of the things we will talk about in security architecture is highest level of segregation. So in Azure, the highest level of segregation, is it subscription or tenant?
Tenant.
And yeah. When I say I need a dev account, or sorry, I need a dev environment or a test environment, would that be I have a dev tenant and a prod tenant?
It depends on the organization. You can definitely do that as well. You can definitely, it does complicate a lot of deployment options and everything. But if you really want to segment out to a point where you have different identities, because now if you have a dev tenant and a prod tenant and a QA tenant and so on, technically your identities are different. You have to actually maintain them. Like, you have to invite users to that. You have to. It's not as straightforward as it sounds like. You have to change between directories. You have to change between tenants, and then you get access to subscriptions within that tenant. So it's doable, but not. Maybe some organizations do that way, but you also could segment out between a tenant. You could have subscriptions, and each subscription is allocated to provide a certain service or a certain environment, to host a certain environment.
Right.
That way, you still keep your identities common. Like, it's one account that I have, I can log in the same account to both dev, test, production. Yep. But then my access on each of those subscriptions will vary. And that's where we want to, like, you know, do custom rollback access. And as we go higher in the environments, we start to narrow down the permissions and what we can do, what we cannot do, and, you know, and so on. Yeah.
Great. So when we go into the whole demo mode, we probably see all of this in action as well. But I'm curious from your perspective then. So from a practical perspective, anyone who's thinking about doing security architecture in Azure, they probably should consider having having segregation at a subscription level rather than a tenant level, just for quote unquote being cloud native, I guess.
I don't think there's like one solution fits all. I think it depends on the organization.
Yeah.
But it depends on how, we have seen organizations that actually have a separate tenant just for dev, so that it's more, they can maybe have less governance on it and let anyone do what they want to do. But then it depends on how large the organization is, what kind of applications you're dealing with, what kind of compliance requirements and other stuff that are actually there.
Yeah.
But easiest approach to keep it easy for administration would definitely to be starting with like one tenant and multiple subscriptions, and then do segmentation within the subscription. But if you're a smaller organization, maybe with lesser compliance and governance requirements, then maybe you could even have one subscription that actually has all the three environments, but then do very narrow access control between in the same subscription as well. Because Azure, the way permissions actually work is either you can inherit the permissions from the subscription level, or you can actually go as narrow as resource level permissions. So you could actually assign permissions to resource groups, to resources, and you could actually even do custom role definitions which actually apply to only certain type of resources. So answer is, it depends, but easiest administration and the fastest implementation would be to have one tenant, multiple subscriptions, and each subscription hosting a certain type of environments.
Yep.
And whenever you're doing non-prod subscriptions, you also could go with the dev test subscription, which is kind of having lower cost and also lower availability and lower services from Microsoft. They're not technically production ready. So, you know, you can actually host services there, and then you can actually kind of take advantage of the lower cost with that subscription type.
All right. So you can actually say these subscriptions are for dev and test.
Yeah. And they charge you less for it.
Oh, there you go. That's another good thing to know as well. And by the way, for people who are listening in, feel free to drop in your questions if you have any. I think we're just basically setting the foundation at the moment for what security architecture in Azure can look like. So we spoke about identity. We spoke about segregation as well. And I think we can't finish the conversation of the identity without talking about RBAC, as what you mentioned. There are a couple of other terms that keep coming up when people talk about Azure and security architecture as well. I mean, we're not going to cover all the services in this part. We have a part two coming up as well. But from a setting up a multiple, I imagine what you said earlier with the small to business, small to medium sized business, you have an Azure AD, you have one tenant, multiple subscription possibly for different dev, test, and prod. How does this scale up into like a bigger organization where I guess what happens, and where I'm coming from is a large organization, unlike a small to medium sized business, would have multiple business units. Each business unit might say, yep, great, I have Azure Active Directory, but I want my own silo thing because I'm special, Snowflake, or whatever. How does this scale up in a larger enterprise context?
So we would still scale the number of subscriptions, but then definitely management of subscriptions become a challenge, like management of, like, for example, if you have like the sales BU versus the human resource BU versus maybe a finance BU and someone, just some examples, right?
Yeah.
And each of them have their own set of applications. Each of them have their own set of deployments that they want to manage and everything. You could technically go to each subscription and manage permissions, but that actually becomes too much complicated. It, you know, you're considering you have two or three subscriptions per BU, it becomes too complicated to actually go to a subscription manager. That's where we want to use something called management groups. Mm-hmm. And group all of the subscriptions under management groups and then assign permissions at the management group level, which will then get inherited to the lower subscriptions, which are members of the management group. You could even go further narrower, wherein for production maybe, or maybe for stage, or maybe something which is more sensitive, higher priority, have SLAs and stuff to meet. You could go narrow down and assign permissions only to that one. So that way, you only have two places to manage permissions and not like half a dozen places to manage permissions for each of those applications. Like one is at the management group level, which gives access to everything, and then narrow down just to the production subscription to manage production level access, which may be smaller and more custom. So that, right. I think management groups really help do kind of ease out administration when you have multiple subscriptions and multiple resources in large scale context.
Right. And to your point, how would normally, like, what would you see as the change in team as well? Is there some insight on that? Because I imagine with an SMB context, it's just, if it's just you and I, it's just you and I running the whole company. I guess there's no the special cloud security engineer or cloud security architect. Basically, you and I figuring out what the Azure structure would look like and basically going up with it. And you can correct me if I'm wrong, but that's my assumption. And sure. How does that scale in terms of teams as well? What do you, I mean, and you don't have to give us like a specific example. It could be like on average, what do you see other companies have?
So when you say from a team, like how do we provision per team?
Oh, yes. As in like, so from a team perspective, I imagine from a cloud team perspective, like, you know, mm-hmm. how you have like, oh, so you and I start, I'm just making up a use case here as we go through this. I have a dummy company, let's just say Cloud Security Podcast, and we start today. It's just you and I, the employees. You're the CEO, I'm the CTO for some reason. And we basically build the company and we go, okay, Azure subscription started today. And you basically said, okay, we've got separate devs, separate tests. We hired a bunch of devs. Business did really well. And now we've grown to a point where we need to start to have, we have a business unit where HR needs its own thing. We have finance needing its own thing. How does the team normally change as well? I mean, there's like a whole incident response and all that. Keeping that aside, from a cloud perspective, do you feel like there's a lot more architects, security architect, cloud security engineers? What else do you see in the teams, I guess? That's kind of where my question
DevOps is. Engineers, you get DevOps engineers.
Yeah, DevOps engineers. Yeah, like those kind of things.
Yeah, then you get SRE. Yeah, you get SREs and so on. And then you have the application team itself who are responsible for the overall development and deployment of application, maintaining it and so on, like SREs. And so I think it's a multi-part answer I want to say, share. So one, we would start off with properly organizing the team members into groups in Azure AD, like create groups for them and give them, yep. assign them to respective groups. And then each group will actually be assigned a custom role, either the management group level or maybe the subscription level. Either ways, whichever works for that scenario at that point of time. And whoever's part of the group, you know, get all access to the stuff that they need based on, you know, that's been assigned to them. And if suppose it's a dev person, they're part of the dev group, and then they only get access to do deployments and maybe minor changes to resources. And then SREs have more level of access, and DevOps engineers have the highest amount of access where they can govern access to others and so on. And then you'll have security engineers, security architects who will have access to the security aspect of the platform, like to maintain Defender for Cloud policies, to maintain Azure Sentinel, to look at alerts, configure rules, configure monitoring parameters, all of those things which basically result in the security of the environment itself, which is a different viewpoint into the whole tenant. So you have you have various viewpoints into how the management of the resources are actually happening at the tenant level. Each of them get to see what they have to only see. They don't get to see other things.
So you would not even see the options that you're not allowed to access.
You can, yeah. So if you, based on how you define the roles and everything, you can definitely block out like the others. Like for example, if I only have access to a resource group, I only have access to a certain resources in the resource group, I only get to see them. I don't get to see other stuff. I can see everything with respect to that. I can see alerts for that. I can see logs for that. I can see everything that I'm having access to, but then I can't go around and like, suppose I'm working for application A, I can't go around and poke application B because I don't have access to it. You can define it in that way.
Yeah. That's pretty awesome.
It all depends on how we kind of configure and plan out the whole org structure and how we plan out groups.
Yeah.
And that's, again, I think from my point of view, it's best to have one tenant and multiple subscriptions and have this level of segmentation set up at subscription level. Like human resources will not be able to see the finance team subscriptions, and finance will not be able to see sales and other subscriptions. Like it's all very clearly segmented out, and only the cloud administrators or platform administrators or platform architects will get access to see everything else, and they can then administer and govern all the access as needed.
Awesome. And I think it's definitely worthwhile calling out, because people who from the AWS space would kind of realize that what happens in an AWS context is that, for example, to what he said, that I should not have access to the organization, which is business unit HR. Let's just same example. But in Amazon, what happens, I would still see the service. But when I try and access the service, I mean, service probably a bad example, but if the service, let's just use the word service here. But I would still see the service. When I try and access the service, it would deny, saying I don't have permission, which I found really unique about Azure, where if you don't have the permission, you don't see it. So I would never even know that there is another one. But in the AWS space, I can see it, but I can and try and do something with it. Just say, oh, you don't have the policy for, or you don't have the permission for.
Oh, here we can't even see it. So there's no metadata as well.
I don't know which one's better, but maybe organizations can make the call for what's better for them. But that was really interesting, man. So maybe, cool. I feel like I've covered the foundational pieces, and we can go into the demo as well. But unless you feel like we should cover anything else before we go into the demo.
Sure. So I think one other thing which I want to talk about is, so now we have the tenant, we have management groups or subscriptions. One other thing which we always, recommendation, even Microsoft recommendation as part of their documentation as well, is to start kind of put in guardrails using Azure policies.
Mm-hmm.
So now we have some foundation of RBAC, some foundation of management of resources. We have a tenant, we have everything configured, but then it still doesn't fulfill the needs to say, is the subscription ready to be handed over to dev teams to start doing what they want to do? And what else could go wrong in this whole scenario? And that's when policies is where we want to apply policies. Policies, again, can be applied at the management group level, a subscription level, at a resource group level, at whatever level in these three of these, and wherein we can very specifically allow, deny, or even maybe auto-remediate a certain device configuration or resource configuration on Azure. Like, suppose if the app dev teams are trying to deploy a SQL database, and we have to ensure the SQL database is not exposed to the internet, it's only having private access, it's only allowed with a private endpoint, and so on, we can either do something like, we have a policy which either deny the configuration that they're doing, or it'll let them do what they want to do, but then auto-remediate it by going and reconfiguring the database to say, I see a SQL database, I'm going to go and enable these policies, enable these settings on it so that it's more secure. We actually have those options as well. So that way, as a cloud administrator or as a security administrator, we don't have to go and keep following up with application teams to say, hey, go secure an environment, go do that. We don't have to do that. Automation takes care of it. And we can focus on really the critical alerts that we get through, not through all of these configuration mismatch alerts. That's another thing which we want to look at. So that's, after this, I would say the subscriptions and the environments are ready to be handed off to the application teams, and then they can start doing their development and whatever they want to do. And we have a guarantee and assurance that they can't bypass these guardrails. At the same time, they are free to do what they want to do as long as they're within the guardrails of security basically the security best practices or configuration practices for the resource. And as we go to various tenants, we can actually configure more policies as needed. So yeah, that's
pretty cool, man. I think, and what I'll love to see it. And I think Kyler is definitely excited about the demo, as she's pointed out over here. She's definitely excited. Yeah. So I think, okay, that's such a good point, because once you've laid out the foundation for a subscription and tenant, before you just, I mean, because a lot of people just go, oh, well, I've defined the team, I've given them the right permission, I've decided that I'm going to use subscription as my separation. And then the third thing being at that point, RBAC, I've done the RBAC as well, but management group, if I need management group. But then after that, before you even hand it off at that point, I'm sorry, you still should have Azure policies, which to your point, are the guardrails before it becomes a shitstorm.
Yeah. Guardrails is absolutely important. Else, what happens is the teams don't feel that they're using cloud services. They start to feel they're using on-prem services for everything. They have to go ask somebody, hey, can I do this? Can I do this? And then we go fix it for them, or we deploy it for them.
Right.
And then it starts to, you know, start to pile up. As we have larger and larger teams, larger and larger organizations like going down this route, there's definitely going to be a point where the help desk or the cloud administrator team cannot keep up with the number of requests we're getting through. Might as well just give them the control, give application teams the control. They know the application, they design the application, they know what they need for the application. We know what we need for keeping the environment secure, at least best practice wise. And we'll put in the guardrails. And if suppose the guardrails is blocking them, we can have a discussion, and that's when they want to come back to us and say, hey, we need this exemption for so-and-so reason or something like that. Or hey, some client is not allowing us to do this, we need to do something like this, and your policy is blocking us, and that's when they want to come back to us. But until the policy doesn't block them, they're free to do what they want to do. Sweet. And I'll show that in the demo as well. I'll show a policy definition. I'll show you how we can apply it, and then we show like how it gets denied when you try to do something that is not in line with the policy.
Well, we have a question from Cloud Security Architect here. There's a Cloud Security Architect asking how to manage permissions across multiple subscriptions.
Best approach would be to use management groups.
Managing groups.
Yeah.
Also, the same example we were saying earlier, that we have a HR group, we have a finance group. So
true.
We create managed groups for them. That allows us to have permissions across for Ashish and Sai onto those management groups as well?
Are hierarchical. So we have a tenant level management group, and then we have multiple subscription, multiple lower management groups under the tenant. And suppose I have a DevOps team for, say, HR. And they're only doing HR applications. I give them access to just the management group that's responsible for HR applications, which have all the HR subscriptions and everything, human resources, applications and everything. If you and I are platform architects and platform administrators, we get access to the root management group or a tenant level management group, which have access to all management groups under it, which means I have access to all subscriptions under it. Mm. That's how I would want to manage permissions across multiple subscriptions. Doing it one by one is not practical. Once you start to grow out of more than two, more than three, managing it one by one is not practical at all. So that's why management groups are the best way to do it.
Awesome.
And we can stack them. We can stack them. Yeah. Basically, I'm just saying we actually can stack them and put them in hierarchy so that we can ease out the whole structure.
Cool. Now, hopefully that answers your question, Cloud Security Architect. Feel free to ask more questions. I think he or she should have the job already, but...
This was not showing up earlier, so sorry, I think
technically jumping. No, maybe reset and start with what are we looking at?
Okay, yeah, sorry. So just to go back to the question that just came up, so management groups, so this is a brand new tenant I created, and I created a brand new subscription called demo subscription under the brand new tenant called. This is using my Outlook email ID. So I created one. This will be the tenant that we created. So this will be the tenant. The tenant ID will come up over here. And then we have, this is the Active Directory that we create. So this is basically tenant. And the tenant could be, you know, multiple things under it as well. As like I was saying earlier, it could be other Microsoft cloud services as well. This is the first piece of it. Once we have the tenant created, you want to go to subscriptions, and it will basically say you don't have any subscription, and then you want to create a new subscription, and then you fill in, you know, how you want to do this, all that stuff, and then once it's created, we, you know, get a subscription. So for this, I'll not show that for now. I'll close this out.
Is there like is there a charge per subscription kind of a thing? Because it says
no, it's so no, there's no charge for subscription. It's free to get started with. And also, I think a couple of services are free all the time. A couple of service tiers and service plans are actually free all the time. And if it's for the first time you're doing it, you also get a $200 credit and stuff, which you can use to, you know, get started and get your hands dirty in Azure and so on. After that 1 month or something, then you have to start paying for it if you're using services. But unless you really have a service, and if you don't, unless you have some actual utilization, there's really no charges to it. Even if it is, it's very minimal charges to it.
Right. I've got a follow-up question from Cloud Security Architect as well. Mm-hmm. Would you use a separate IGA tool or Azure AD, or Azure AD is good enough for a large business?
Personally, I always stick with native services. I don't want to use a third-party tool to manage permissions and access, because now the third-party tool has access to all of the stuff, which may not be something that, you know, an organization might desire. It depends. Again, I want to say it depends on the organization and the skill set and everything else. But personally, I would use native tools available. Native tools are good to, you know, create custom roles, to create, you know, permissions, RBAC roles, and everything else as well. It's very visual. It's very clear to understand.
Sweet. Hopefully that answers your question. Feel free to ask a follow-up on it if you like. Because I think, so for the context, IGA tool, what is IGA tool? Is that an Azure thing?
I was thinking it's a permissions management.
I'm just thinking some kind of an IAM tool, I guess. But maybe that's where it's coming from. But so I'll let you come back to this one. So, all right, we're looking at, what permission do you have? So when you create a subscription, are you like a, I don't know, like a root user, or what's
the owner? Owner. The default permission, the default one is an owner. The highest one is an owner. You have multiple other roles as well. I'll show that quickly. So if you come into here and we come into access management and go to role assignments or roles, we get to see various other roles that are defined. All of these are built-in default roles, and we also can create custom roles if needed. It's fairly straightforward in my opinion. So you can do add new custom role, and it's very visual. And if you're JSON friendly, you also can do a JSON based definition format. If not, you know, you could actually look at the entire permission sets available and click through each of those options and say, you know, like for example, if I do virtual machines,
yeah, you can just do image builder for the moment if you like.
Yes, some example, like, you know, you actually have all of these like specific roles that I can actually say, and I can say, you know, this role has access to do multiple reads, no writes, no deletes, and stuff like that. So it's basically a read-only role for something very specific to this resource itself. So they only have access to this resource type and only have access to read. You know, they can't do anything else other than that.
Interesting. So what's a role? You know how in the traditional red team world, because we have a lot of hackers who watch this as well, what's a bad role? So actually, maybe not the right question like that. What's a role that people should be very careful with? I'm assuming owner role is the role that people should be very careful with, like not leave the secrets for that anywhere.
Yeah, owner role is one of them. And there's also another role which we get to see at the tenant level. So it's called user root administrator or user access administrator. It's the highest role possible. You can actually, let me see if I can show this here. So it actually, maybe I'm not sure. Maybe I'm not getting it because I don't have that level of.
Well, if you go to users, I thought there's like a global administrator, right?
Global administrator is actually for Azure AD. So if you're, so yeah, this is Azure AD role. So Azure AD has different roles again compared to your subscription. Azure AD roles are defined over here. Yeah.
Right. So that's interesting. Because I'm putting my hacker hat on, because what used to happen is whenever we would do like a pen test or some kind of a exploration of some sort, our goal always used to be you need to get domain admin. So is this the equivalent of domain admin, global administrator? As in, if I have access to this account, I can log into any tenant which is linked
if you have access to this, yes and no. So if you have access to this role, you have access to all of Azure AD.
Yep.
And if you could either add yourself to groups, which then give you access to stuff, or there's another option, which I'm not able to find it over here at this point. It's actually some place where you actually get user root. This one. So right. Either you could do that, or you can actually toggle this on. And the moment you do this, what happens is your ID gets root privileges across the entire tenant. And you can then do anything you want to do in the tenant. So if you come back now here, and if I look at, let me see if this works, and I can show you. If I come in here, you have user access administrator, which is equivalent or higher than owner.
No, you don't want to give away access to.
Yeah, this one is basically like a break glass approach. If, for example, the person who created the tenant left the organization or something, and they've forgotten to provision access correctly, or delegate access to somebody else when they were leaving.
Yeah.
The global administrator of the tenant can take over access to all subscriptions by toggling that button, that switch that you just saw. Right.
But no one should have it turned on by default.
It should not be turned on by default. And it shouldn't be a default thing enabled for everyone or for anyone for that matter. It should be only a break glass approach.
Sweet. Talking about break glass is a question from Vineet as well. His question is, on day zero, we should create break glass accounts too, or what's your suggestion?
I think I would say always have at least one or two cloud. So it depends on how the account is configured. My answer is always depends, because there's a lot of options available. So if you're doing an Active Directory, so when you do Azure Active Directory, right, you have an option to sync your on-prem accounts or sync your on-prem Active Directory users to Azure Active Directory. In that scenario, I would say on day zero itself, you should have a few cloud-only accounts, which are delegated for administrators. So just in case your sync is broken or something happens where your on-prem accounts or your traditional Active Directory accounts can't log in anymore, you want to use your cloud-only accounts to be able to log into the tenant and perform some administration tasks. By default, you always have one. That is the one which creates the tenant itself. And other than that, it's always good to create a few more. You want to do this, and you want to say cloud account, and you want to select a certain domain and go ahead and create. These are outside your synchronized accounts.
Yep.
But it's only something, but there's only applicable if you're doing a directory synchronization. If you don't do directory synchronization, then everything's cloud only accounts, and there's really no, I don't think there's a break glass account for Active Directory itself.
Interesting. So the approach is to have a user available which can do the break glass thing if required, kind of a thing.
If required, yeah. With WMFA and everything, yeah.
Right. And just to follow up from that, then, do you know how we were talking? Thanks for your question, Vineet. Would you say then, would you create just the, I guess we haven't got to the point where we're creating dev tests. We're just basically setting it up so we can start creating subscriptions for dev tests before we hand it off.
Correct. So we have a tenant, we have subscription, and I'm not yet ready to give it to anybody to use. Yeah. I have to do a few more things before I can give someone to use it. So before that, I'll actually create groups on Azure AD and then come into access controls and then create custom roles and give the groups the required access into the roles. That's step number two. Step number three, which is something that I want to focus on more, is policies. So once we have access management set up, we definitely want to come into policies. There are a lot of policies that will help us set up some guardrails. Enabling every one of them is not practical, but we want to select the top few or a top which are applicable to our environments, and which will give us the best security posture within the environment. And we want to select them and apply them. So I applied one before our call. This is to restrict storage accounts access to networks. So basically what this policy does is, if someone tries to create a storage account, like an S3 bucket equivalent to Azure, and expose it to the internet with no network controls or no access controls and so on, this policy will deny it from happening. So basically, you can't
create a storage account. Can you just broadly say storage, or do you have to call out, hey, blob storage, or like, can you broadly say
storage account with storage? So storage accounts have multiple services under them. Blobs are one of them, queues, tables, file shares, all of them are actually under them. And this is applicable to all of those services, which is classified under storage accounts as a whole.
Right. Okay.
It could be anything. It could be any of those three services you're trying to create.
Right. Sweet. And I don't have to just individually define, because tomorrow there might be a fourth or a fifth one that gets added by Azure.
So as long as they're actually categorized under this service type, then there's nothing new to be done. But if they have a new service, like, for example, if you're trying to do something, so this will not prevent Cosmos DB from being exposed to the internet. This is only for storage accounts only. If there's a new category of databases or storage which is not categorized as storage accounts, then you have to have a policy for that.
Right. Okay, cool. That answers my question. Thank you.
Sure. So I'll show you how that looks like. So I go to storage accounts and I say create a storage account, and I leave everything as it is. I leave everything as it is. We'll do demo test policy for demo, and force of habit, I'll just do a proper LRS to keep cost low. Go to advanced, leave everything as it is, and good networking. This is basically telling the storage account is exposed to the internet.
Yeah.
No restrictions at all. Typically, we don't want to do this. We want to do something like this, or do something like this totally, which is only going to use private endpoints. So I come into here, I keep this as it is, and I'll go to next, and I go to next, and I click on review. Validation is running to see if, you know, the settings meet the policies that I've set up for. Is actually going to say, you know, you can't do this. It's saying that, you know, this storage account you're trying to create is disallowed by policy, you know, a reason denied due to security configuration, contact help desk.
Right.
Now, there might be a genuine reason why you want to do this.
Yeah.
There might be a genuine reason. So that's when the application team or the DevOps team who are trying to do this will need to reach out to the help desk or to administrator team and say, hey, can I get exceptions? And this is the reason. And we go through exception management and go through that whole process. This is a very simple example, easy to set up. So I use this one to go through. And I'll pause there. Any questions?
Yeah, I think I definitely have a question. A couple. So
sure.
To your point, there might be a scenario where someone may want to have an exception, but maybe or may not be a storage. So I can just go back to those Azure policy and they should already be like, I mean, I imagine every category that is in Azure should have a service equivalent there in policies.
Yeah, so that's where I want to say go to definitions, and the definitions actually have categories, and the categories define all the stuff that you could do. End of day, these policies are JSON definitions. Mm-hmm. And if the policy doesn't exist, we can actually write one capturing a certain aspect of the JSON definition. So I'll again go back to the one I just showed you. This one, this is an easy one to talk about. So I'll just keep going back to this one.
Yeah.
I go to view definition. This is basically all of this stuff is the JSON. It looks very much like the ARM template. And I'm saying policy rule. And I say this service. And if this field of this service from the ARM template point of view is not equal to deny, then you know policy effect will the policy effect is actually applied to it, and the policy effect defaults to deny.
And I also see on the top under essentially says category storage. That's how you know that this is a policy that's affecting the services that are classified as storage.
Correct. So this is more to do with the definition. So if I want to come back and I don't want to write my own one, I just want to say I want to see what all Azure is giving me by default.
Yeah.
I can click on definitions, and what I can do is I can actually look at all the categories, or I can say I want to specifically look only for, say, key vaults, right?
Mm-hmm.
And I want to say key vault only, and key vault should have push protection enabled. We already have a good number of them which we can apply, and this will suit or this will fill almost every purpose of a key vault. Like key vault push protection must be enabled, and even if it's not available, you can definitely open this up and, you know, look at how this is defined and then change a certain value and say, if this doesn't exist or that doesn't exist, and then that's how you want to start writing your own policy.
Yeah, awesome. And I think Vinith has kind of come back with a comment, and I think this was going to be my follow-up question. We can use infrastructure as code IAC for writing these as well, because clearly it's JSON.
Yes, you can. So you can, these are JSON. You can actually use IAC. I don't think we can use IAC. I don't think we want to call it IAC specifically. We can definitely use DevOps pipelines or GitHub Actions and so on to actually deploy these policies across multiple tenants. So in the scenario where very large enterprises have multiple tenants for various aspects of their environment, then you definitely want to do some kind of an automation DevOps practices to deploy these policies. Then it doesn't become practical to go to each tenant and apply each of these policies each time there's a new subscription and so on. So you want some automated process which does all of these for us. And they can be automated, they can be used, we can definitely use pipelines to implement these. I think other thing aspect is, if you're using IAC to write code and deploy environments, policy definitely can be used as a gating criteria. Like how we saw the validation fail, if suppose writing your environment in say ARM templates or Bicep or something like that, right? In the validation phase of the Bicep implementation or ARM implementation, if you're voiding a policy, it's going to block you. Yep. It's going to block you saying, hey, this template is incorrect or it doesn't meet your organization policy, go fix it. It's very proactive.
Oh, that reminds me of another question. Would it still work if I'm using Terraform instead of using ARM template?
No, Terraform, I don't. So far, at least, I've not seen Terraform which can be being blocked by these policies, especially in the validation phase. Terraform will get blocked in the apply phase. When you're doing Terraform apply, it's when Azure is going to start getting the definition that Terraform wants to apply, and then Azure will give an error saying, hey, you know, you're breaching this policy. I can't allow you to do it, and it'll error out. But Terraform doesn't. It's not as friendly as ARM and Bicep. ARM and Bicep will fail at the validation phase. Terraform will fail at the apply apply stage when you already have code merged into the main branch and so on.
Oh, that's an interesting definition. And by the way, I was going to say, just quickly on Vinicius's point. So you mentioned you would not call it IAC. This is more like policy as code, I guess, rather than IAC. Is that what
people say? I think so. I've not used that word terminology, but you could call that policy as code, or these are technically code. This is definitely like JSON code. I think you can use automation to deploy it, but I don't know what is it exactly called. I don't think it's called infrastructure as code though, because it's not really.
Because I think I definitely have heard people talk about policy as code, and thanks for the question as well. At least thanks for the comment as well, Vinit. Because I think the way I've heard people talk about this is because they talk about the fact that, oh, you want to have guardrails, but if guardrails are being applied as a code, how do you talk about it? But because it's not technically infrastructure being built, it's just stopping something wrong from happening while the infrastructure is being built. So it's like, at least that's where I've used the word policy as code. Then I don't know, maybe people might start using it after as this as well. You and I may have coined a term over here, man. Policy as a code. So what I was going to ask, and to your Terraform example as well, because you mentioned deployment phase versus validation phase. Yeah. Because I think a lot of people may already be doing this beforehand. It's like, so I may already have a Azure tenancy, and now someone who's listening, or you basically start today, I've basically been doing a really shitty job of keeping Azure secure. And like, you've come in, you know all about Azure policies. So what happens to the stuff that's already created?
So there are two approaches, right? When we have policies, policies can be applied in multiple effects of the policy. So it's called policy effects. So you have an option where I can actually audit and give me a report of all the stuff that is breaching this policy. And I have like, say, 10 resources that need to be remediated and so on. That's one approach. So it works very well for resources that are sensitive, and we can't just go and automatically start making changes, but we just want to know, I just want to know a report of all the stuff that is incorrectly done in my tenant. So I definitely want to put a policy and just do an audit. But if I'm 100% sure that upcoming resources must definitely meet these requirements, then I also want to do a policy saying deny, wherein any upcoming resources that don't meet these requirements get denied. These are two options that we have. Now, suppose it's a very trivial change, like I just want to enable, like say an example of, I want to enable diagnostic settings for all resources.
Yeah.
It doesn't really impact the application. It doesn't really impact resource. It's only going to impact cost. And we're going to say, I'm okay for this. Let's just go and do this. That's where we want to do something called deploy if not exist policy type. And what that basically means, I'll show an example of that. What that basically means is, if a certain configuration doesn't exist, I can actually set it up automatically. This is a good example of this. So this one actually says deploy if not exist policy. And what it means is it's actually going to verify a storage account. It's going to see if diagnostic settings are not enabled for the storage account. And if it's not enabled, like this is the policy validation check. If it isn't enabled, what it's going to do is it's going to deploy this ARM template on the storage account. Basically go and fix it for you. So that way, you know, anything that's already existing will get auto-remediated based on how it is, like based on what we define in the whole template and the whole policy. And it's very simple to do it. So if you want to do an assignment, you just do assign. And I'm just doing like a very simple use case. I'll say I want to assign it to a subscription, or I want to assign it to like a management group or whatever. And then, so I have management groups as well. I can say apply the management group level to all subscriptions in the tenant, or I can say only do it for this tenant or the subscription. And I say select, it shows up over here. And the parameters, it's going to ask me, hey, give me the log analytics workspace to send these logs to. I can drop down, I can look at the log analytics workspace. Then I do remediation. I say, yeah, create a remediation task. And this one is, it's easy to leave it at this, but I don't want to use this one. This one creates like a random ID and doesn't really help us track it. So I always prefer using this one. User managed identities, and I'm going to say, I'm going to select the scope, and I'm going to say in this subscription, find this. And I'm going to say this is the identity that I want to use, right? And then I say next, and I we leave this blank for now, and I say review and create. Yeah. So it'll take some time to set up, but then what's going to do is it's actually going to give the identity access to the tenant. It's going to give access to all the stuff. It's going to scan the subscription for all resources that don't meet that are categorized under these categories, and if it doesn't meet these parameters, it will go ahead and configure the workspace diagnostic settings. That's basically what it's going to do, and we can verify. It's going to take a while to show up correctly. We can verify that at coming here, and within some time you'll see a remediation task being set up, and once it finds all subscriptions and it finds all the resources, it'll start going and remediating it for you automatically.
Awesome.
Very long answer for a short question. So
No, but I think it definitely makes sense as well. I think from a perspective of, because a lot of questions that we've gotten in the past always has been around the fact that what do I do if I already have a messed up Azure subscription thing that I'm trying to control of. To your point, there's a cultural question as well there from a DevOps perspective. Like, do you want to really upset your developers and just basically go hammer approach and just, no, from this point onwards, the Azure policy has been applied on everything and you can't do anything, any changes. It doesn't affect the existing resources unless you make a change to it. Is that right?
Yeah, So, correct. So, in case I do a policy, let's say I have a messed up environment right now and I come in and we put all these policies.
Yeah.
All the stuff that is messed up will continue to be messed up as long as I want to go touch it. If I go touch the storage account and I say I want to make this small change, then the change won't go through. It's going to tell me that, hey, you're breaching this policy. You've got to fix this attribute of the storage account or this key vault or this SQL database as well.
Yep.
And then it'll let you pass through the whole whole deployment phase of the resource. But until that doesn't, until you don't touch it, it'll just be as it is. And once you make a decision from an enterprise-wide or organization-wide and all architects agree and everything, that's when you want to do auto-remediation and go fix all the resources automatically using remediation policies as well.
Yeah. There's a comment from Abraham as well, setting the policy to audit first as well. Just to investigate.
So I think we covered that a few minutes ago. So before we reach that state of going and making changes, you definitely want to do an audit. So that, you know, you don't want to go and start messing up environments and starting to cause, you know.
You don't want to deny it for step one, right?
Yeah, step one, don't want to do that. You definitely don't want to do that. You want to audit it. This deny only works if it's a brand new subscription, like brand new stuff. You're creating it for the first time and you're giving it off to somebody. Do this and give it off to somebody. But then if you're kind of inheriting a subscription that already has resources, then do audit first and then plan to remediate it based on architecture and design and everything else that might be, you know, that might be impacted.
Yeah.
The last thing you want is security causing an outage.
You don't want an outage. No, you definitely don't want a production outage. Thanks for the comment, Abraham. This has been awesome, man. I think I learned quite a bit. I'm sure others did as well. We've got a comment from Cloud Security Architect to cover more Azure Native Security Services and best practice for hosting public-facing solutions. I think part two is next week, and we're probably talking about public-facing solutions, or at least web app. Stay tuned is what I'll say at that point in time. Anything else that you wanted to cover? For people who are interested in any more topics around the Azure security best practice or how a security architect or a cloud security architect should look at, feel free to drop those questions in. But definitely, feel free to kind of just follow the channel or whatever thing you can do, so at least you get notified when the next episode is out. What else do we have to cover, Sai, for Azure policy?
No policies. I think I'm done. I want to share a few links with Microsoft documentation. You know, that details out more of how the policies work like and what all options we have and everything else. We just covered like a very small aspect of policies, but this document actually covers a lot of it. And also want to talk about, you know, a repository where all the policy samples are there. You know, you can, if you have a custom policy that you built for an organization, please, you can contribute it over here as well, so that others can use it. And if not, you know, you can definitely look at all the policy that someone is contributing, so that you can actually take advantage of somebody that's already built it.
All right, you don't have to like build from scratch like a custom policy.
You have so many of them already available. You don't have to build it from scratch, definitely not. And if in case something's not available in the definitions, then you can look at, you know, GitHub and other resources for custom definition that someone already wrote for you. You can copy that as well.
I think Vinny found Terraform has Terraform has like an Azure policy option as well. There you go. You learn something new, man.
I think you can deploy it. Yeah, you can deploy it for sure. But then it doesn't work like how ARM templates work, where validation fails if you're breaching a policy.
Oh, so the resource would still get created, but when it's trying to get created.
Good. Sorry. I think completely.
No. Sorry. So is that right? So Terraform would basically say, if I'm creating a virtual machine and the Azure policies deny virtual machine creation, it would try creating it. Or sorry, if it'll create storage, it'll create everything else. And then suddenly when it comes to virtual machine, it's going to be like, oh, by the way, I got failed. But everything else that was supposed to be created is already there.
Yeah, correct. Yeah. That's how Terraform works. But if you use ARM, ARM will actually stop it before that itself and say, hey, I'm validating your code. Your code is good, but then you're breaching a policy. So go and fix your code. It won't even go to the point of... So basically in a DevOps practice where you're having pipelines and branches and everything configured, for Terraform to run, you already have code merged in with incorrect, basically code that actually breaches a policy already is merged into the development branch or deployment branch. Yep. But for ARM templates, you know, you can skip that in the PR phase itself. In the pull request or merge request phase itself, you get validation error saying your code is good, but in you're breaching policy. So go fix it.
Right. So I guess you favor ARM templates over Terraform then for building resources.
Only for... Only with this kind of a scenario. There are other tools that actually provide, and that's where we want to maybe talk about some third-party tools and stuff, but there are other tools that actually provide the service for third-party solutions like Terraform and, you know, any other, you know, IAC code tooling.
Oh, yeah.
But then native services are, you know, best working for native solutions like ARM templates and Bicep and so on.
Sweet. Awesome. Now, thanks for that, sharing that as well, Vinith. I'll let you come back to your resources. So, and I'll put the resource links into the YouTube description and sort of the LinkedIn thing, so people can actually check that out as well. Cool. I love the resources as well, man. What else would you want to cover?
Last minute policies also help not only with security but also with cost control. So if you want to limit, you know, certain resources from being created, if you want to prevent an expensive machine from being deployed, policies are still your best friend. So you can actually define that over here. So if you say SKU, you can see what machines are allowed. You only can say machines that cost like less than $100 a month or something only you allow. You block like large machines which cost like thousands of dollars a month. You actually can block them from being created. So policies not only just serve for as security benefit, they also serve as a cost controlling aspect as well for the subscription. That's the last one I want to talk about for policies.
Oh, you could just go on for this forever, man. I think it's a good conversation is all I would say. And we're getting to learn quite a bit as well. There's a comment here from Anurag Chatterjee as well, drawing an analogy from programming world. ARM is compile time versus Terraform is runtime error handling. It's probably a good way to put it.
I'm not the programming person, so I didn't know to put it that way. I definitely would agree with that statement, though. Yeah,
it makes sense to me. So I definitely feel Anurag is on the money there. Thanks for that, Anurag. Well said as well, man. Awesome. That was pretty much most of the stuff that you wanted to cover. There's a part two coming up as well. So, let me just remove this for the moment and then come back over here. We have a part two coming up as well. So for folks who have suggestions on what they would like us to cover, looks like Cloud Security Architect wanted us to cover the hosting of public-facing solution as well and some more native security services. We'll see how much we can cover of that in the hour time that I take from people. Sai, thank you so much for doing this, man. I really appreciate this. I learned quite a bit. I'm sure others learned quite a bit as well. Looking forward to having you for part two as well, man.
Thank you, Ashish. Thank you for having me.
No problem, man. Thanks, everyone. And we'll see you in part two. See ya.